Darkcast Network. Indie pods with a dark side.
On December 13, 2009, Stephen Kocher disappeared after parking his car in an upscale neighborhood in Henderson, Nevada. Stephen had no known associates in Henderson, so no one knew why the 30-year-old drove there that day. Was he there for a meeting? A job? No one in the neighborhood admitted to knowing him or to having plans to meet with a young man that day. As the investigation went on, bank records revealed a series of bizarre road trips that Stephen had taken in the days leading up to his disappearance. Trips that he had told no one he had been taking. Over the years, as family, police, private investigators, and internet sleuths continue to dig, more questions have come up, but none have led to the answer that everyone has been searching for. Where is Stephen Kocher? When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Stephen Kocher. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode and is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. Okay, so we're back for part two.
We're back.
So sorry to those of you who had to wait. Today, we're going to wrap up Stephen's case and talk more about some of the people in his life. We're also going to talk about theories, and I'll say up top that the one I ended up with was very different than the one I had going into this.
Where does it align with my theory coming from the first episode?
Well, we're not going to talk about that now.
Okay.
We are going to talk about that later.
All right.
So if you haven't listened to part one, you're definitely going to want to do that because we're just getting straight into it. So you can find that episode below this one wherever you're listening. Before we jump in, though, we've had a bunch of people join us over on Patreon, so we'd like to take a moment to give some of them a shout out. Thank you to Reming R, Carrie M, Amanda, Angie, and Samantha S. Thank you so much for your support.
Thank you all so much.
As a reminder, if you'd like to get our episodes ad-free and sometimes early, you can join us over on Patreon at any level you want, starting at just $2 a month. And you'll also get a free copy of the ebook that I wrote. All right, so there we go. We got that out of the way. Let's get into part two, the finale of the Stephen Kocher story.
All right, let's do it.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, when we left off, Henderson police had publicly stated that there was no evidence of foul play in Stephen's case. And there wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, there's no blood in the car. There's no sign that the car was even broken into. There's video evidence of him walking off on his own, and then he's just gone.
Exactly. He was driving into the neighborhood. He was walking confidently. Yeah. I mean, because I showed you the tape, and it absolutely didn't seem like he was disoriented.
No, not at all.
Under any type of duress.
Right.
But unfortunately, Stephen's car wasn't processed thoroughly by police because they didn't believe that a crime had occurred. Because like you mentioned, there was no blood, there was no sign that had been broken into, like nothing that would make them think this was anything other than a guy who just left his car where he shouldn't have left his car.
Right.
So there was definitely potential evidence that was missed. In fact, I'm not even sure if the car was ever impounded. It might have just stayed in the cul-de-sac until Stephen's family drove down to Henderson to retrieve it. So it might not have actually been processed at all. So I do know that it was processed maybe on the scene, you know, like police looked into it, obviously. But again, there was no thorough.
Like physically just looked in the windows?
Yeah. And I think they probably like looked in the car. I mean, they did. They looked in the car.
Yeah.
But I think more in a superficial kind of way.
Yeah.
So one of the few technical clues that we have in Stephen's disappearance have come from his cell phone. While no one saw Stephen after the camera captured him at noon on December 13th, his phone continued to be active for a little while after that. The phone didn't have GPS. Again, it's 2009, so they really had to rely mostly on cell tower data.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen's phone did continue to ping after he was last seen. Around 5 p.m. on December 13th, so again, 5 hours later, Stephen's phone pinged on a tower near the intersection of Arroyo Grande Boulevard and American Pacific Drive in Henderson, which is more than 10 miles north of where his car was parked.
Interesting.
So it is interesting because it's 10 miles away 5 hours later. You could theoretically walk.
You could. Yeah.
10 miles in 5 hours.
Right, but why?
Exactly, why? And no one has ever reported like seeing him or somebody who matched his description walking, you know, in that time, but you might not, you know, people walk, like, and it's not necessarily something somebody would have noticed. So again, he could have physically still been in possession of his phone at that time. About 2 hours later, around 7, it pinged another tower near the Whitney Ranch area, which is just a couple miles further north. Then, in the early hours of Monday, December 14th, the phone pinged yet another tower near the interchange of Interstate 515 and Russell Road, which is even further north, roughly at the eastern edge of Las Vegas. Then after that, the ping stopped, so the phone either died or was turned off and was never turned on again. And yeah, so like the distance and the time doesn't preclude Stephen from having it.
Right. Time-wise, I mean, it makes sense. Like he could have been walking.
Yeah. Or he could have gotten a ride. Like he could have been doing any number of things. But like there's the physical possibility that
the phone was still with him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But why?
Well, exactly, right? But so interestingly, before it turned off at 6:52 a.m. on December 14th, Stephen's phone was used to check voicemail. Now, it's been assumed that this call was to check his own voicemail, but apparently the call was to the general AT&T voicemail retrieval system, and that number can be used to check anyone's voicemail. So there has been speculation that it might not have been Stephen checking his own voicemail, that it might not have been somebody with Stephen's phone checking Stephen's voicemail, that it could have been somebody else entirely checking their own voicemail.
With Stephen's phone.
With Stephen's phone.
Mm.
But of course, if that were the case, that would have meant that Stephen was no longer in possession of his phone by the next day, which we can't know for sure.
Right.
There's also the possibility that Stephen left the neighborhood willingly, but without his car for some reason. So the family checked with nearby cab companies to see if anyone had ordered a pickup, you know, that afternoon of the 13th, but they came up empty. Of course, a cab isn't the only way to get out. Now, in 2009, we didn't have Uber, we didn't have whatever. So like in terms of calling somebody to come pick you up, like a service, it was going to basically be a cab company, but he could have prearranged with somebody else to pick him up. Somebody who he was meeting within the neighborhood could have driven him somewhere. He could have left the neighborhood and hitchhiked.
Yeah.
You know, like any number of things could have happened. The only thing we're reasonably sure of is that he didn't call a cab. And it's important to know, too, that early on, people weren't really looking at this through the lens of foul play, because when you're looking at a potential crime victim, especially one where you don't actually know if a crime has occurred or not, you've got to kind of look into the victimology and see how high risk they are. And Stephen was extremely low risk for foul play. You know, he didn't drink. He didn't do drugs. He had never been involved in anything illegal. Like, he had a strong support system. He had all of these things that put him at the very bottom of the list in terms of somebody who would fall victim to violent activity, right?
Right.
I mean, obviously, violence can happen to anyone at any time. But if you're looking at statistics, if you're playing the odds, like, they weren't there. There was no reason for police to immediately jump to foul play. And so they didn't. So at the beginning, a lot of the searches are really focused on kind of a search and rescue.
Assuming that he wandered off into the desert or
exactly
got lost or whatever.
Yeah. And that was really what they were thinking was more likely. And I do believe that that was more likely at that point. Stephen's family organized volunteer search parties and followed up on every tip. In April 2010, about 5 months in, a private investigator named Craig Retke helped coordinate a large search of the desert area south of the Henderson Executive Airport, not far from Sun City Anthem, where Stephen was last seen. This search was prompted by a tip from a reliable source that that area might be significant. Dozens of people, including Stephen's parents and volunteers from his church, marched through the rugged terrain in the hot sun. Nothing related to Stephen was found, but Deanne Kocher said that the outpouring of support gave them energy to keep going, saying, quote, "We knew we needed to do something, to start searching somewhere," end quote.
How close is this executive airport to where his phone last pinged?
It looks like it was roughly 20 miles away.
Okay.
So this went on for months. Family members built timelines, pored over credit card receipts, and searched through Stephen's laptop. They spoke to everyone who knew Stephen, just hoping for a piece of information that would lead them somewhere. They gave interviews to news media in an effort to keep Stephen's name out there. Stephen's parents, Deanne and Rolf, gave extensive interviews for an episode of Disappeared that aired about their son. Sadly, before it actually aired in 2011, tragedy struck the Kocher family in another way. Stephen's father, Rolf, passed away from a sudden heart attack that February, never knowing what happened to his son.
He had to have been young, right?
He was. I think he was in his 50s.
Damn.
And this was heartbreaking for the family and for those following the case. By then, Stephen had been missing for over a year with no answers. As time went on, small bits of information would surface now and then, but nothing that definitively answered the mystery. But new efforts would periodically be made. In 2015, a nonprofit search team called Red Rock Search and Rescue came up with a new theory and decided to conduct another search in the Henderson area. Their theory was that Stephen may have wandered into the hills and mountains south of Sun City. Maybe he headed into the rugged desert foothills and succumbed to the elements somewhere high up where previous searches had uncovered. Red Rock spokeswoman Olivia Nizalek told reporters, quote, "The theory we have this time is the subject decided to go high into the mountains," end quote.
But again, we're left with the question, why?
Right. And I think the answer is either disorientation or suicidal thoughts. And getting back to Mason Smith, who we mentioned in the first episode, he's our other case that we've covered out of St. George, Utah. That ended up being the prevailing theory for him. They believe that he walked out into the mountains to take his own life. Now, in Mason Smith's case, there was a note left behind that has not been publicized, but might have led people to make that conclusion. In Stephen's case, there's nothing like that. It was just kind of, again, like I was talking about, he's just so low in terms of potential like foul play, the odds of that, that they were thinking, okay, a 30-year-old man, it's more likely to be like mental health or, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah, but then why would you buy like a frozen meal?
Again, maybe it was a split second decision to not return to his car, because that happens too.
That's true.
Sometimes you're making a plan for one thing and then there's a split second decision to do something completely different.
But then why would he park in that area and not park closer to, you know, a trailhead or something? Like why park in this residential 55 and over community?
Well, because maybe he did have some sort of reason to be in that neighborhood. Like maybe he was, let's say, going for a job, right? And it didn't work out. And at that moment, he was like, you know what? I can't do it anymore. Again, it's all speculation, but I'm just saying like that could be an explanation.
Yeah.
So 2015, we're talking over 5 years. since his disappearance. This is the theory they've come up with. So in May of that year, they deployed about 50 volunteers across a 25 square mile area of wilderness near Anthem, searching washes and higher elevations. Stephen's brother Dallin flew out to join them, expressing hope that, quote, new resources and new energy, end quote, could finally bring answers. Unfortunately, after an extensive effort, that search also came up empty. No trace of Stephen was found in the mountains. Now, here's the weird thing that happened with this case, and is actually how I first heard about this many years ago. Amid the investigation into Stephen's disappearance, he was linked to the case of another missing person from Utah, Susan Cox Powell. Susan Powell vanished from her West Valley City, Utah home just 1 week before Stephen, in early December 2009. The timing and the fact that they were both young Mormon adults led to idle speculation.
Ooh, that they were like trying to escape the church?
No, not the church specifically, just trying to like leave and start new lives. So this popped off when Josh Powell, who was Susan's husband, who was already a suspect in her disappearance. So, because I know you're not familiar with the Powell case, like it's not a very huge, tragic, awful case. Her husband, Josh Powell, was already a suspect in her disappearance. And he and his father created this website of like, you know, help find Susan Powell, right? And in it, they were like talking about all these possible things that could have happened to Susan, you know, like why she could have disappeared. And it was that website that they're like, well, there's this 30-year-old who is also a member of the LDS Church who went missing a week after Susan. And we think they ran off together to Brazil.
He did do a mission in Brazil, right?
He did. And so I think that's where that came from.
I mean, is there any evidence at all linking the two of them other than the fact that they're Mormon and they went missing a week apart?
None. Absolutely none. To everyone's knowledge, they've never met. They never communicated. Nothing. There's absolutely zero evidence of any of this. The whole thing was basically an attempt to deflect attention away from Josh. And police saw through it. So they dismissed the idea of any connection between the two cases very early on. Because you don't know, I'm sure a lot of people listening already know, but Josh Powell later killed his children and himself in a massive house fire. And he is believed to have murdered Susan, but no body has ever been found. As the years went on, Stephen's case stayed relatively quiet from law enforcement's perspective and was eventually transitioned to cold case status with the Henderson police. But in recent years, a pair of private investigators, Jim Burke and Kevin Wyatt, took an interest in the case and have been working pro bono to dig up new leads and theories. In a 2024 interview with KUTV, Burke noted that some of Stephen's actions in those final days, quote, are a little bit unsure. We still don't know why, but he was definitely doing something for somebody else, end quote. Wyatt suggested that given Stephen's pride and financial struggles, he might have gotten, quote, hooked up in something that may not have been in his best interest, end quote, in an effort to make money. So what could Stephen have gotten himself involved in?
Drug mule.
Let's talk theories.
It's my theory.
I'm so excited to tell you about our sponsor, Avocado Green Mattress, because they have certified organic mattresses with thoughtfully chosen materials that are designed to support healthier living and more restorative sleep, which I know we all need. Because better sleep changes everything. It changes your morning, your moods, and your energy. And their products are built to last with durable, high-quality materials. Avocado products are an investment in long-term vitality. They're not a short-term fix. Plus, you can be sure that you'll have no regrets because you'll get a sleep trial of up to 1 year to ensure that you're getting the best mattress for you. When it comes to what you sleep on, real wins. Real is better. Go to avocadogreenmattress.com/ATTWG to check out their mattress and bedding sale. That's avocadogreenmattress.com/ATTWG. avocadogreenmattress.com/ATTWG. Most of us are trying to get healthier, but we're guessing about which habits actually matter for our bodies, and we're all different. So what if you can measure how your body is aging and know exactly what to focus on next? Listen, I need instructions, and that's what True Diagnostic does. They test your biological age and key health markers, and then they give you a clear 90-day plan based on what your body needs without the guesswork. The test is so easy to take at home. They send you the kit, you take a little finger prick, send it in, and then you get this amazingly detailed report back that tells you everything you need to know. I'm so excited to get my next round of results to see if I've improved or what's changed in general since the last time I took it. I'm really interested in the True Health test, which tests over 105 biomarkers, including vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and fatty acids, to understand my system's health right now. True Diagnostic is trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. And right now, my listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using code ATTWG20 at checkout. That's truediagnostic.com and use code ATTWG20 for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the combo kit as a one-time purchase or subscription. It's so cold, and the ice crashing off of my roof just shattered a table on my deck. So no, I don't really want to cook right now. Luckily, Factor makes healthy eating easy with fully prepared meals designed by dietitians and crafted by chefs. Ethan and I both have our own Factor meals coming, and I'm really excited because I'm a vegetarian, he's not, so we're able to get different things that we can have for lunch. He can take it to work and heat it up there. It's super easy. And they use quality functional ingredients, including lean proteins, whole foods, and healthy fats. Plus, they have 100 rotating weekly meals, so you're not just stuck eating the same thing over and over again, which honestly is why I can't meal prep. And they have many different options: high protein, calorie smart, Mediterranean, GLP-1 support, everything you could want. It's always fresh, never frozen, and ready in about 2 minutes with no prep and no stress. So if you want to try it out, you can head to factormeals.com/ATTWG50off and use code ATTWG50off to get 50% off and free breakfast for a year. Eat like a pro this month with Factor. New subscribers only, varies by plan. One free breakfast item per box for 1 year while subscription is active. We've established that Stephen was struggling. He was short on cash and had fallen behind on his bills.
Too prideful to go to his family to ask for more money.
And in addition to being several months behind on rent, according to Tina Bishop, his landlord, Brett Bishop's wife, he was also behind on utilities, and the companies were threatening to shut off services. Now, his roommate Jordan had also been behind, and I mentioned in episode one, he had moved out toward the end of November 2009 without telling anyone.
So the only hole with this theory, admittedly, my own theory, and I'm still supporting it.
Okay.
The only hole is he doesn't have a connection to any of this.
Like, correct. Where is a young Mormon man going to
Now, of course,
become a drug mule?
Who knows? Like, that could, a contact could have been made anywhere, right? But
right.
This is not somebody like, he doesn't even drink caffeine, let alone alcohol. So it's not like he's going out to bars trying to score smack or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe it was somebody who his former roommate knew. Those contacts could have been made anywhere, but it's unlikely that he would have established it himself.
Well, exactly. And that's what everybody was thinking, right? Because I think a lot of people like you would immediately go to drugs, but then once you kind of get to know the person Steven was, it's like, wait a second, how does that actually work? How does that actually make sense?
I mean, who knows? It could have been a conversation with his roommate when they were both struggling. And his roommate was like, hey, I know this guy. Here's a potential easy way for you to make cash.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Could have been something like that.
It very well could have been. So, yeah. And I think that, you know, once Steven wasn't found immediately. And after months went by and they did all these searches and he still wasn't found, I think that that's when people really started to kind of think outside of the box a little bit more, right? Obviously, over the years, a lot of people have theorized that Stephen's circumstances, like I'd said earlier, led to a depression, which culminated in him taking his own life, likely somewhere in the desert. And, you know, sometimes bodies just don't get found. Some pointed to his bizarre series of drives in the days leading up to his disappearance as some sort of mental break, which we also kind of brought up. And, you know, a mental break could either fit with a suicide theory or with the theory that Red Rock Search and Rescue had, that Stephen had become disoriented and wandered out into the desert where he succumbed to the elements. I still think that even though so much time has gone and his body hasn't been found, like, those are still possibilities. I mean, everything's a possibility until a body's found.
Yeah.
But to me, you also have to look at everything he did up until the moment he vanished. And it all suggests that he planned on coming back. Now, you know, I already said earlier in this episode, you know, sometimes these things can be a split second decision, but not always. As Dallin pointed out, you don't buy a bib for your baby nephew if you're about to vanish on purpose. And you probably wouldn't park your car full of personal items in a place where it'd be found so quickly if you wanted to remain hidden. So to me, as I was like going through this and kind of learning about everything, I started thinking more about foul play. One of the early versions of that theory that police and the family looked into was the idea that Stephen was lured to that neighborhood in Henderson by a fake job or a meeting. There are early web sleuths posts with people searching Craigslist ads trying to find one that Stephen may have answered. The idea is that Stephen might have been lured to that neighborhood under false pretenses, like a phony job offer, and then something violent happened afterwards.
But didn't you say his family searched his laptop and didn't find anything?
Exactly. But, you know, he was carrying something that looked like a portfolio, a resume, you know, something along those lines. Like, it could have been writing clips. It could have been anything that you would take to a job interview. So if someone had said, hey, I have a quick freelance gig, a job lead, you know, whatever. Can you come to this address on Sunday? That might explain why he went to Anthem of all places.
But there's no digital trail of that.
Yeah, there's no digital trail of that. And I think even what's more than that is that he didn't mention it to anyone. Because Stephen's parents were obviously concerned about his financial situation. You know, the landlord had called them. They knew something was up. Like, they knew he had been struggling. So, like, why wouldn't he put his parents' minds at ease? You know, why not say, hey, I've got an opportunity for a new gig. It's not a done deal, but I have an interview coming up. You know, just something along those lines, right, to just make them feel better. But he didn't tell anyone that. Plus, like you said, there's nothing on his computer that indicated anything like that. There's nothing found in his car, his room, nothing that said he was heading to Henderson, Nevada for a job.
Had his phone ever pinged in this neighborhood before?
Not that I've ever seen, no. From everything I've seen, it appears that this is like the first known time he's ever been there.
First and last.
Yeah. So the next theory is one I didn't really think much of at first, but as I dug into the case to write the script, it slowly evolved into being the theory that I believe, that Stephen was involved in a criminal activity gone wrong. Now, again, like we just said, the reason I didn't believe this at first was because there's just no indication that Stephen was the type of person, right, who would get mixed up in
it
something like
It doesn't
fit
that. With his profile
it,
at all.
Not at all.
But desperate times, desperate measures.
Right. But the investigation didn't reveal a double life or any evidence of something that would lead him to become desperate enough to turn to a life of crime. Plus, a police canine searched Stephen's car. So that's why I said there was some search done. But I think this was done on site. Like, again, I don't think the car was ever impounded. But in any case, a police canine did come to the car, and according to his father, Rolf, because he talked about this on the episode It Disappeared, the officer had been a canine officer for like 20 years, and he confirmed that there was no trace of drugs in the car. He said, there have never been any drugs in this car.
What type of drug, though? Spoiler alert, Kona and I are married, and she asks me random questions that I do remember.
Just without any context.
Without any context, but I knew you were writing this episode, so she asked specifically if canines were trained to hit on illegal drugs or prescription drugs or somewhere in between if there was a mix. And I didn't know because I'm not a canine officer. I have no idea. But go ahead.
I Googled it. And from what I've been able to find, canines, like drug sniffing dogs, are typically trained to just find illegal drugs. However, they can be trained to sniff out prescription drugs, especially the commonly abused ones. So like hydrocodone, you know, like
Oxy.
Yeah, Valium, like things like that. They can be, but they're not always. And so Henderson Police 2009, I don't know that that dog would have been trained to sniff out prescription drugs.
Right. It might have only been cocaine, amphetamines, heroin, meth,
pot. Yeah, all of that kind of stuff. And there was absolutely no trace of that in Steven's car.
But he could have been running prescription drugs.
There could have been prescription drugs.
There's a little insight to our family life here.
Yeah.
To our listeners.
Oh, and my search history, which is because he's like, yeah, I don't really know. And I was like, all right, well, let me Google it. And of course, now my dumbass is Googling, can drug dogs sniff out prescription drugs?
Now our county sheriffs who
already love us
so much, yeah, are going to just randomly pop by and do, do sweeps of our cars.
When I asked you that, I was writing this, I was kind of like asking some questions, finding out some new things, maybe thinking of a theory. And you and I have talked many times before on the show about how you don't believe in coincidences.
Absolutely not.
I do, but not always. And in this case, there are a lot of weird coincidences.
Okay, good. So you're
on my
side.
That I don't like.
There's no chance that this guy randomly starts taking these wild ass road trips when he's strapped for cash and then suddenly finds himself in a retirement village in outside of Las Vegas and then goes missing.
Yeah.
And none of that is connected. Bullshit. It's all connected.
Well, again,
whatever he was doing,
I thought it was all connected the whole time too, but to more of like a mental health episode.
I don't know. I don't know. I would be more on board if it were in a shorter time frame. So like the road trips happened, but he was interacting with people
in between
yeah, his family,
his church,
ex-girlfriend's
parents. Yeah.
The people from church, and nobody raised any suspicion. Nobody even said that he was acting any way other than the way he normally acts.
Right.
So if it's a mental health crisis, I feel like there would have been
other signs.
More signs. Yes.
Yeah, I think you're right.
In particular, in the interpersonal relationships that he had with people.
Yeah, you're right. Because he was maintaining regular contact with everybody in his life.
Right. He wasn't like randomly self-isolating.
Right.
Doing crazy shit.
Other than the drives.
Well, I mean, yeah, he know? Was, but
yeah.
that's not.
Yeah.
I don't think the evidence is there of a mental break.
Yeah.
I think he was getting involved with something, whatever it was, as a way to make money. And it may not even have been illegal. I don't know. My first instinct is drug mule.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows? It could have been anything that maybe wasn't illegal. But whatever it was something off the books that he didn't want his family to know about.
Right.
So, yeah, back to your original point. No, I don't believe in coincidences. This is all interconnected.
Yeah. So my first thought, where I was like, okay, maybe this isn't mental health. Maybe there really was something more to these drives that wasn't just like within him. I was like, well, let's look into Jordan, his roommate.
Okay.
Because, you know, I read in some of the articles and whatever that he smoked marijuana in the house, which obviously Steven didn't approve of. But it made me wonder if Jordan's involvement with drugs went a little bit beyond that. So I looked him up, but he doesn't have much of a criminal record. He has charges for possession and contributing to the delinquency of a minor from 2007 when he was 19 or 20. So to me, like the contributing to a delinquency of minor, that could mean you had a 17-year-old friend.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, you were providing drugs or alcohol to your buddy. Yeah.
To your buddy, like who just wasn't 18 yet. Like when you're 19 or 20, like that to me, you know, that doesn't, if he's like 45, like that's different.
Right.
But yeah, so he had that. And then, so that was 2 years prior to him meeting Stephen. And then 2 years after, in 2011, he was found guilty of resisting a police or correctional officer. But other than like a couple just random traffic tickets, that's it. Like, I haven't seen anything after 2011 and nothing that indicated he was like heavy into drugs or crime. Despite this, Tina Bishop, the landlord's wife, said in a Web Sleuths post that she had heard rumors that Jordan was one of the biggest drug dealers in St. George.
One of the biggest drug dealers?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And she said that she even heard that directly from a cop, but not even a police officer in St. George, a police officer in a totally different jurisdiction in Utah. Like, apparently he was so big that people in other parts of the state knew about him. And would just like, I don't know, tell Tina that. But he's never been arrested for dealing or possession like one time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't put a whole lot of stock in that.
Yeah, so I thought that was like kind of a weird post. But what I found weirder about the post was that Tina made this claim about Jordan, but failed to mention that her own husband, Brett Bishop, was facing some pretty serious charges of his own at the time.
Ooh, deflecting.
The Unfound podcast covered Stephen's case a few years back, and they uploaded a very interesting police report to their website. The original complaint was from a car dealership in Phoenix, Arizona. On April 25th, 2005, they reported that a silver 2005 Porsche Cayenne Turbo was stolen from their lot. And this is when we finally get to talk about Orem, Utah. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your personalized closet. Then they show up to your door in as little as 2 days. And let me tell you, I'm on the other side of the country and they still got here super quick. Then when you're ready for new clothes, you just swap them out. I'm an elder millennial, and so jeans are kind of like the thing that I can't figure out right now. And so in my new bag that I just got, I ordered 2 different pairs of jeans because I'm still trying to figure out what actually works for me. And I love it because I can rent high quality designer clothes without having to make that financial investment. Plus, there's no laundry required and no time wasted shopping. So right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 60% off of their first month. That's up to $150 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, ARMOIRE. .style/ATTWG to get up to 60% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side, your Sleep Number setting. Enjoy personalized comfort for better sleep night after night. And now, during our President's Day sale, take 50% off our limited edition bed, plus an extra $100 off all mattresses. End Saturday. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I was wrong on the drug mule. It's a car theft ring, isn't it?
Well, there's a lot to this police report.
Okay, go.
In an incident report from the Orem Department of Public Safety, dated August 7th, 2009, Lieutenant K. Brown begins, quote, "Several weeks ago, an anonymous tipster called the police department and left a message. The message, which was delivered to me, indicated that the police may want to check the garage at the address of 311 West 170 North in Orem, end quote. Now, the message he's referring to that he received states in part, quote, "The complainant saw a 2005 Porsche SUV in his neighbor's garage. The complainant had never seen the vehicle before and asked why he never drove it. Brett told him he could not afford to get insurance or register it. Brett also did not have any plates on the vehicle. Around 1:15 hours, the complainant saw Brett pull into his home driving the Porsche, but this time it had a plate on it. The complainant believes Brett is trying to hide the vehicle for some reason," end quote. Now, the Brett referred to in this report is Brett Bishop, Stephen's landlord. He and his wife Tina owned the home in St. George and kept a bedroom there, but they lived full-time in a rental in Orem, Utah. So police checked to see if there are any reports of stolen vehicles that match that description, and they found that report out of Arizona from the car dealership. On August 6, 2009, investigators went to the Bishop's home in Orem to interview Brett, but a neighbor informed them that the family had gone out of town a few days prior. In the meantime, they were able to secure a search warrant and performed a search of the garage while Brett and Tina were out of town. When police entered the garage in Orem, they immediately saw a silver Porsche Cayenne that matched the description of the one that had been stolen in Arizona. They checked the VIN number on the dashboard, but it didn't match. But then one officer got out his pocket knife and he was able to peel off what turned out to be a fake VIN that was on top of the real one. The real one, of course, belonged to the stolen Porsche. In addition to the car, they saw several license plates lying out in the garage. They ran one, which was an Arizona plate that they believed was the one the neighbor had seen on the Porsche. It came back as being registered to a holding company in Virginia and belonged on a Toyota Tundra. So, okay. It looks like Brett Bishop was pretty clearly in possession of a stolen vehicle. But so what? What does that have to do with Stephen Kocher? This also happened months before his disappearance. This was in August of 2009. Kocher didn't go missing till December 2009.
Not a coincidence. It's not a coincidence. Like, he's the landlord. Steve's behind on rent. He also happens to have, at the very least, a budding auto theft business on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he knows well enough to overlay a fake VIN on top of
the existing VIN. Yeah, that's pretty impressive, I thought.
Yeah, to say nothing of the stolen plates.
Yeah.
Like, this is not his first rodeo. This guy's done this before. So to me, it's real easy. The connect there is, hey, you're behind on rent. I got a couple of things that you could do for me on the side. Running plates.
Plates. I didn't think of plates.
What do you think was in the portfolio?
Well, we're going to get to that.
Could have been license plates.
It could have been license plates. You're actually right. Yeah, car registrations. Shit. Yeah.
I was thinking
fake
drugs
VINs.
The whole time, but no. Yeah, fake VINs, plates, car registrations.
It could have been anything like that.
All things that could very easily fit into something the size of a portfolio or a shotgun envelope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that wasn't the only thing police found that day.
Okay.
In his report, Lieutenant Brown said that while he and other officers were waiting for the tow truck to come to impound the Porsche, a Detective Watson said that he smelled marijuana in a nearby cupboard.
Was there a Detective Sherlock there too?
Shut up. Other officers noticed a gun case in the garage that held several firearms. Before Lieutenant Brown had executed the search, he had obviously run a report on Brett Bishop just to see what he was dealing with, right? He said that the paperwork he received indicated that Bishop was a convicted felon. And I have looked at his record. The charges he's referring to are like forgery, like things, you know, maybe like passing bad checks, kind of things along those lines.
Right. But he's a convicted felon, therefore not able to legally own a firearm.
Well, yeah. So that's what Lieutenant Brown thought, right? So he was like, okay, we have the stolen car. We've got all these guns that he shouldn't be having. Detective Watson over here smelling marijuana. He's like, okay, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
So long story short, they filed an amended warrant and did an expanded search for guns and drugs.
Because right, they can't seize the guns or drugs because that's not part of the scope of
the original warrant.
The original warrant. And if they were to seize that and arrest him on that, that's fruit of the poisonous tree. So they couldn't actually bring any of that to court.
Right. So, yeah. So they filed for an amended warrant, got it, and then continued their search. And apparently this garage had like many different rooms off of it. And it seemed pretty big and like there was a lot going on. And they searched it all. During the search, they located several license plates from multiple states. They also found, using a canine, marijuana, scales, and other drug paraphernalia. There was a total of 10 guns that they found, including handguns, shotguns, and an AR-15. They also recovered what appeared to be a homemade silencer and plenty of ammunition of all types. But that's not all they found. They also found a large amount of prescription pills.
And there is the question. That's the reason why you asked me that question.
They found numerous pills that were just loose, along with many bottles of prescription medication with different names on them, none of which were Brett Bishop. An arrest warrant was written up, and Brett Bishop turned himself in the following Monday after he returned to town. He was charged with possession of a stolen vehicle, possession of firearms by a felon, and multiple charges of possession of a controlled substance. In the course of the investigation, Lieutenant Brown discovered some more information about Brett Bishop. They spoke with a recent employer of Brett's named Mark. He said that he had met Brett about 6 years prior when they had been both involved in a business called United Off-Road Rock Crawlers. I don't know what that means, and it doesn't exist anymore. So like nothing came up when I searched it.
Proximity to Red Rock Cavern or the desert in general. I mean, I would assume that off-road rock crawlers would be kind of like modified Jeeps or modified SUVs that would do off-roading.
Yeah, that's kind of the impression that I got. That'd be something along those lines.
Yeah.
But they would have events and Brett volunteered and would help put the events on. And they were all very impressive and said he was a great worker, you know, really dependable. They liked him a lot, but that business eventually folded. So when it did, Mark and his business partner, a man named Ranch, brought Brett on to work for them at their new business, a closed door pharmacy.
The hell does that mean?
Well, it was a business that delivered prescription medications to places like rest homes and youth centers. And so I'll just read from the report about what Brett's job was at this closed door pharmacy. Quote, most of Brett's job was to look through a binder, take note of when certain medications were running low for individual patients, and make sure that other medications were being ordered. He was around prescription medications all day. Medications were received in this building in bulk and then divided up into 30-day supply packets by a host of employees.
My God, it's the perfect recipe for somebody to skim off the top.
Yeah.
And just have a ass load of prescription medication that nobody's tracking because it was all ordered above board.
Yep.
But it was skimmed off the top.
Yeah. And Brett has been asked to deliver some items on occasion, and there is speculation that a rest home or care center may have given outdated medications to Brett for disposal, end quote. So, yeah, so that part of it was not in policy, but they're like, yeah, it could be very possible that when Brett was going to make these deliveries, some of the people were like, hey, we've got some of this expired medication. Do we give it to you? And he's like, yes.
Well, yes.
You
do.
Yeah.
That might also explain why Steven was in a 55 and up community.
Yeah.
Could have been making a delivery there.
Right.
Or picking up.
And apparently a lot of the bottles of pills that police recovered that day were expired. So I think that's kind of why they got to that theory that maybe like he had been skimming off the top, which would account for the loose pills.
Right.
But then maybe taking expired medication, which would account for the bottles of pills.
Yeah, and then selling it off off the street.
Yeah, because nobody gives a shit. Like, you can't look at expiration dates when you're buying Oxys off of somebody on the street, you know?
Yeah, and just because they're expired doesn't mean they're not effective.
Exactly. Lieutenant Brown also learned that back in April of 2009, the company received an anonymous email that said one of their employees was ripping them off. The email didn't name Brett, but based on the information within it, Mark and Ranch believed it was referring to Brett, and they terminated him. So let's fast forward to December 2009. Brett Bishop has been fired from his job. It's unclear if he had managed to find another one.
Other than, you know, selling stolen vehicles.
Yeah. And he's facing several felony charges. On top of that, he has a child who requires daily injectable medicine, according to his wife. She posted about that on Web Sleuths, too. He's renting a home in Orem, and he owns a home in St. George, but he's renting it out to two guys who aren't paying the bills. And one of them split at the end of November. So by December, Brett is under a lot of pressure and the cops are watching him. He's under indictment.
So he can't do anything illegal to make money. But Steven, his tenant, who's behind on rent, hey, I got a deal for you. Come and do these things for me. I'll cut your rent down to nothing, or we'll call it even, and just deliver me the money.
Exactly. According to Tina, Brett, quote, was trying to work with Steve, and Steve had paid a little bit. He had been paying some part of the utilities to keep them on and making promises and plans to catch up the rent, end quote. So yeah, what if Brett offered Steven a job? Something completely above board. He can tell Steven, hey, I work for this closed-door pharmacy, and they need another person to make deliveries.
All I need you to do is pick up this envelope here. Drive it over here, drop it off. It's completely legal. It's not, but
yeah, but
that.
I mean, but he could easily tell Steven that it was, because it has basis in truth, right? As basis in an actual legal business.
Right. Do this for me. Keep it quiet. We'll take care of your rent.
Yeah. And, you know, so maybe the deliveries were pills or money or prescriptions or VINs or license plates or whatever.
Right.
And maybe Brett didn't want Steven to tell anyone about it because he was hiring him to help out with his job, basically like a subcontractor, but the actual bosses didn't know about it.
Right.
You know, like, I could see it being pitched like that.
Yeah.
Like, hey, this isn't an official opening. I just need some help because of, you know, XYZ, like whatever. I need an extra hand. I'll pay you under the table if you can help me do these deliveries. But you're not an official employee of the pharmacy, so like, keep it quiet.
Yeah. That would explain all the running around. It still doesn't explain the disappearance.
It doesn't. So, but, you know, you can see how this could happen. It would be a win-win,
yeah.
You know? Steven could make some money, pay Brett back, and Brett could scale down on his deliveries, still have money coming in, but without doing a lot of suspicious activities. Plus, if he and Steven are in communication, that's normal. Like, it's a landlord-tenant relationship. They
Absolutely.
Should be in communication.
Yeah.
Like, nothing is weird about that at all. And, you know, of course, obviously, this is all speculation, but people who knew Steven said that he was a little naive. And the idea that he became an accidental drug runner isn't out of the realm of possibility. Like, they don't believe he would have made the conscious decision to become a drug runner, but they can see him easily, like, being talked into it and thinking that he wasn't doing anything wrong.
Right. Yeah.
Because again, we're not talking about meth. We're not talking about heroin. We're talking about prescription pills. You know, thing that there's a legitimate use for.
Or license plates.
Yeah.
VINs, car registrations.
And
I mean,
again,
any number of things.
Right. If it's VINs, if it's car registrations, I mean, that's an envelope full of paper.
Right.
You know, you don't know what's in there. Like,
it could have been all of it. It could have been,
yeah.
Hey, I'm going to use you as a subcontractor for this prescription delivery service. Drop the pills off here, pick up an envelope there that has paperwork for me, and
yeah.
deliver it to this other address. And you could have been running all of it and not knowing any of it.
Not knowing a thing. And it makes sense, too, because, like, Steven just needed something short term. Like, he just needed to make it through the holidays. His bishop said he'd help him find a full-time job after the holidays. Like, he was just trying to get by. And so I can absolutely see him agreeing to something like this.
Totally. Yeah.
Coming from his landlord.
Yes. Right. And again, you're talking about him being naive. Like he probably had no idea that his landlord was involved in all of this legal stuff, because why would he know?
Why would he? It's not like it made the news.
Right.
I mean,
it's relatively small time stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, his landlord's like, hey, do this for me. And again, knock some money off your rent. You'll get a little bit of cash. We'll get you going through the holidays, and mm-hmm. and then you'll be good to go. Landlord is like, hey, I've got this runner. I mean, like it's like a perfect storm, right?
Yeah.
But it still doesn't answer the question, what happened to Steven?
Right. One of Tina's posts on Web Sleuths says, quote, I do not think Steven is the type to knowingly participate in illegal activities. I do, however, think he, as many of us could be, given the right circumstances, be duped into something illegal or a situation where he could be taken advantage of.
This is the landlord's wife saying
yes.
This? Okay. Well, you might as well just admit to what your husband had probably verbalized to you.
Yeah. So, yes, it was her husband the one who duped him. Is that how Steven ended up in Henderson that day?
Yes.
The camera shows a man believed to be Steven carrying something with him that looks like an envelope or a folder. Could it have been an envelope with a 30-day pill pack, cash, you know, anything. Like we said, it could have been anything, right? Yeah.
And he didn't know.
No.
And he's the type of person that wouldn't open the envelope either.
Exactly. Because, you know, especially, like, think about it. You're dealing with what you think is an above-board pharmacy. He's a smart enough guy to know about HIPAA.
Right.
He knows that he can't just go digging through people's medical shit.
Right.
Like, he's not going to try.
Yeah. And if it was a sealed envelope of some sort.
Yeah.
You're not, you know, it's different if it's like one of those shotgun envelopes that has the twine that closes.
Oh, yeah.
Versus like, you know, an envelope like with a peeling stick or a licking stick.
Yeah.
Where it's actually sealed.
No, you're right. And so it's like, but yeah, he's not going to go looking through things like that.
Right.
Kevin Wyatt and James Burke, the PIs who are looking into the case, seem to believe that whatever Steven had with him that day holds the answer. Wyatt told 8 News Now in 2022, quote, I think Steven had some debt that he needed to clear up, and someone made him an offer, and he took it probably not knowing what it was, and it resulted in his disappearance and what we believe is his death, end quote. And they believe that it all happened in that Henderson neighborhood. When police canvassed the neighborhood after Steven was reported missing, one neighbor in particular seemed nervous. That person said they did not recognize Steven, had no friends, and did, quote, not trust anyone due to the drug lifestyle that people tend to have, end quotes. It's certainly an interesting statement from somebody in an affluent 55 and up neighborhood.
Yeah, an affluent neighborhood where the police are like, have you seen this person? I don't trust anybody that does drugs.
Yeah.
We didn't ask you about that at all. Like, what?
Now, I don't know if this is the same person, but there was a person who lived in a casita in the back of the property that Steven was believed to have gone to that day. The private investigators obtained photos from that casita that showed several holes in the walls and doors shortly after Steven went missing. Burke told Channel 8, quote, we have photos of a room that was destroyed at about the same time. Is that based on a struggle and a fight and a death? Is it based on a struggle, a fight, and a kidnapping? Is it based on somebody who is just mad? I don't know, end quote. I've seen the photos. They were released to the news when they gave this interview, and the holes look like people punched holes in the walls and the doors, or perhaps put a head through a wall or a door. But there's no blood. There is nothing else that made it look like a violent altercation had happened. So that's why, I mean, it makes sense. Was this somebody who was just mad punching holes in the walls? Was it a fight? Like, you can't really tell.
Yeah.
Now, the person who lived in the casita was named Mark. He wasn't 55. I think he, at the time, was maybe in his early 30s. But his parents owned the home in question. And so for people, because this has come up in questions and stuff, for 55 and up communities, the way it generally works is that only one person on the deed needs to be 55 or older. Everybody else who lives there can be under 55. So, for instance, if you're 55 and your wife is 50, you can both own the house. if, you know, you have two people who own the house, you can have your adult son stay there. Like, none of that's an issue. So this guy, Mark, was apparently living there in the casita in the back. Now, I looked into property records and I found that Mark's parents purchased the home as new construction in 2005 and paid around $405,000 in cash for it.
In cash?
Yes.
Okay.
The parents appear to be real estate investors, and they've bought and sold properties in many different states. In addition, the homes are also often bought and sold within the family, with several of their properties alternating between being in the parents' name, in the name of a trust that they've set up, in the name of somebody I believe to be Mark's sister, in the name of her husband, and even in the name of Mark himself. Though the Henderson home was paid for in cash in 2005, over the next several years, two loans were taken out on the value of the home, totaling $350,000. Mark allegedly moved out of the neighborhood on or around the day Stephen went missing. I've seen some accounts that there was actually a moving van already in the neighborhood on the day that Stephen went missing, because that was supposed to be his moving day. I've also seen accounts that the realtor was actually there for that house, but I'm not 100% sure on either of those two things.
Okay.
So what does seem to be true is that Mark moved out around that time, and then I guess the home stayed vacant. I'm not exactly sure what happened for the next year, but in April 2011, the family just let the property go. And when I say that, I don't mean that they put it on the market and they tried to sell it. They just let it go. There was an unpaid special assessment or taxes, and the current owners were able to swoop in and buy the house for under $10,000.
Wait, who are the current owners? I thought they were the owners.
No, not after April 2011. So they were the owners when Stephen went missing.
Right.
But a year and a half later, less than a year and a half later, they just stopped paying taxes and the house basically went into foreclosure despite the fact that they had paid cash for it. So the people who now own it, it's the same people, were able to buy it for under $10,000. And I know that 2005 was a rough time to buy real estate. That was at the peak of everything.
It wasn't that rough.
Well, yeah, exactly, right?
Like, it wasn't a $10,000 home is a $10,000 home, regardless of where you're at.
Yeah, and this family was buying and selling homes in multiple states all through this time. So, like,
but just let this one go.
Exactly.
Stop paying taxes, stop taking care of it, moved out.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because there's a body under the floorboards.
That's one of the theories. And even though search and rescue dogs were brought out to the area shortly after Stephen disappeared, cadaver dogs have never been there. And even the current owners have been asked for permission to bring cadaver dogs out, and they've refused. They're like, you're going to ruin our property values.
Yeah, that's priority.
Yeah, right.
Right. Like, you're going to ruin our property value. Let's ignore the fact that there is probably a body buried underneath your floorboards. It's fine.
I have seen allegations online that Brett and Mark knew each other through the rock crawling thing, but I haven't seen any actual proof of that. But obviously, if you can connect the two of them, then that's huge. But to my knowledge, that's never officially been done.
It still doesn't answer the question of why. Like, why would they kill Stephen?
It doesn't. No, it absolutely doesn't answer that question.
And you said police were there and saw holes in the walls, but didn't
see
any.
No, police didn't see holes in the walls.
Oh, who did? I'm sorry.
Yeah. So they never went in and checked. I don't know exactly where those pictures came from. They came from somebody after Mark moved out. I don't know who it came from, but those photos were given to the private investigators.
Oh, okay. All right.
According to News 8, quote, both St. George police and Henderson police are investigating the case. Neither department has arrested anyone, nor has either department filed charges or named any person of interest in Stephen's disappearance, end quote. Now, as for all of those charges that Brett was facing, I called a few courthouses in Utah to figure out what happened. Now, I was able to find record of the gun charges online because those ended up being federal charges. but they were all dismissed. Basically, the judge ruled that the Orem police went outside of the scope of the warrant when they found them, so the whole case was tossed. Like, yeah, they eventually did get the amended warrant, but they had, like, seen the guns before that. Right.
They
and
discovered, so therefore it's for the poisonous tree. Yeah.
So that just totally got tossed out of court.
Yep.
It also appears that that's what happened with the narcotics charges, which, you know, same kind of thing, because that was not in plain sight. That came from the amended warrant, et cetera, et cetera. It looks like that all got tossed.
And for the listeners that aren't super familiar, when police execute a search warrant, the scope is very specific.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't just execute a search warrant just to search a house for anything. It's got to be very, very specific.
As to what you're looking
for. As to what you're looking
for. And they were looking for a giant car.
Right.
Which they found.
So once they started searching beyond that, as soon as they start opening cabinets, even if it's just a cabinet next to the car, like, oh, I smell marijuana, let me open this cabinet.
Yeah. So he's trying to do, you know, like, oh, well, I smelled it and that was probable cause, but obviously it wasn't enough probable cause. So what I did find surprising is that the lady I spoke with at the court says that the possession of stolen vehicle charge was also dismissed, which that shocked me because that was definitely under the scope of the warrant. They had him dead to rights.
Right.
But she didn't have any paperwork on it. She's like, yeah, we don't have anything. It's too old. I mean, I'm sure it exists somewhere, but she couldn't give it to me. So I don't know, like, the details of what happened there.
Mm.
But the district court in Orem told me that it was dismissed.
Hmm.
As for Mark, the guy who lived in the house in Henderson, I've barely been able to find any trace of him on the internet, either than being listed as an owner or resident on a few of his parents' properties. But, like, when I go to search for him, when I search his name, when I search, you know, the towns I know he's lived in, he doesn't show up. And even when he shows up on the properties, like, I click on his name and then there's just nothing there. So I've heard rumors that, like, he has a bunch of drug convictions and things like that, but I just don't know. I haven't been able to see any of that firsthand. And it's also unclear how much Henderson police actually looked into him. You know, I don't know if they interviewed him beyond that, like, canvas of the neighborhood. 9 years after Stephen's disappearance, Detective Adam Olmsted from St. George confessed, quote, "We know about as much now as we did the second we realized he was gone," end quote.
I mean, that's not true. Like,
right? I know a lot more.
You know more, yes. just from your research. Like,
yeah, just from looking into this for a week or whatever.
Yeah, I get that a lot of this stuff couldn't be presented in court, but it doesn't necessarily mean you don't know it.
Right. There's, I mean, it at least gives you a direction to go in. And to me, the direction to go in is Brett and Mark.
Yes.
Did they know each other? Did they have any sort of a connection? What's Mark been up to?
Yeah.
You know? Brett hasn't had anything on his record since like 2011, 2012, something like that. Yeah, but like, what is their connection there? What's going on there? You know, to me, this case is solvable.
Or at least there's more to look into.
Yeah, there's a lot more that can be looked into. And from what I've seen from the private investigators and other people who are actually involved in this case, there's just a feeling that police are not really willing to kind of go the extra mile in this case for some reason. And part of it is because it's split between two jurisdictions and that never ends well for the victim.
Right.
But yeah, it just seems like there are a lot more avenues. You know, we've covered a lot of cases where we go through it and it's just like, well, shit, I don't know where else they could go. I don't know where else they could look. I don't know who else they can talk to. But this isn't one of those.
So the thing about Brett's auto theft case getting dismissed, that makes me think that he was part of a bigger ring, perhaps, and maybe
that seems like an informant kind of thing.
Yes, I was just right? going to say, he's
like all, especially the drug charges getting dismissed too.
They brought these charges against him. He flipped. Now he's a CI.
That's what I was. That's the impression
why
I was
all
getting.
Of the
too.
Charges got dismissed.
Yeah,
and that was a separate thing from Stephen going missing.
Yeah, totally.
And now Stephen's disappearance is a wash because they're protecting their CI.
Yeah, I can absolutely see that.
And who the hell knows what Mark's connection is to all of it? There's clearly a connection. Again, same thing. Don't believe in coincidences. We've talked about that. There's no chance that Steven was in that neighborhood with this guy, Mark, who's either moved out immediately, or even if he didn't move out immediately, his parents that own the home just abandoned it and stopped paying taxes on it. There's a connection there. That was where that was where Steven was last seen. There's a connection to all of this.
Yeah, and I don't believe that he was randomly in that neighborhood. Like, he was in that neighborhood for a reason.
Yeah.
And you're right. And again, now that I've looked into all this and whatever, I think that if he was planning on walking off into the desert, he wouldn't have gone to a cul-de-sac in this 55 and up community.
With frozen food in his car.
Yeah. And again, there's no evidence that he was lured there by a job offer, which is like the only legitimate reason, like non-foul play reason I could see him being in that neighborhood and then going missing, right? Was if he was lured there with a job offer, it went badly, and he was just like, you know what? I'm out. I can't do it anymore.
No, I think this was a planned stop.
Yeah, just like the ones he'd been making.
Just like the ones he'd been making, yes. Yeah. And I'm willing to say that he probably had no idea what he was doing was illegal.
Absolutely.
And then something happened.
Something happened. And we don't know what that something is. We have no idea. But yeah, I mean, I think that he was taken by surprise because, one, he didn't think he was doing anything illegal, so he wasn't expecting to be in danger.
Right.
And yeah, and I think that just something happened.
And Mark knows.
Maybe. Allegedly, you know, not trying to get arrested again. But like, yeah, I mean, he's definitely something that if I were a detective on this, I would want to know a lot more information about this guy. And I just don't know that he's really been looked into like that. So whether it involves Brett or Mark or not, over the years, the Kocher family seems to have come to the conclusion that Steven got mixed up in something that led to his death. In November 2025, ahead of the 16th anniversary of Steven's disappearance, his brother Dallin spoke with NBC3, saying, quote, "I personally believe that he is no longer living, and something that he unintentionally got involved in may have caused the situation that we're in today," end quote. He also had a message to the person or persons responsible. Quote, "We don't want to avenge or revenge. We just want to know. And if someone knows something, we just want to have the knowledge and closure, if possible," end quote. The Kochers have faced tragedy on multiple fronts. Steven's disappearance, Rolf's sudden death 2 years later, and now a third tragedy, that as the years pass, their memories of Steven are beginning to dim. Like any family of a missing person, the Kochers deserve closure. They deserve to know where Steven is. Steven Kocher has been missing from Henderson, Nevada since December 13th, 2009. He is a white male who at the time was around 5'11 and weighed 180 pounds, with blonde hair and blue eyes. He was last seen wearing a hooded sweatshirt, a white dress shirt, blue jeans or Dockers pants, and white sneakers. Steven was 30 when he went missing. He would be 46 today. If you have any information on Steven's disappearance, please contact the Henderson Police Department at 702-267-4750. You can also submit an anonymous tip through Crime Stoppers at 702-385-5555. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos on our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!